Since the 1980s, director James Cameron has been raising the stakes for blockbuster movies.
Game over, man. It's game over.
I'll be back.
Is he about to do it again with Avatar?
If there is a hell, you might want to go there for some R&R after a tour on Pandora.
Today in Studio 360, James Cameron tells us about his film, 10 Years in the Making.
When we started this film, it was a leap of faith that we could actually accomplish what we were trying to do because it was a quantum leap beyond what was technically possible at the time.
And later...
Sir, is it true that you are 2,000 years old?
Oh, boy.
Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and the sketch that changed American comedy forever.
You knew Joan of Arc.
I went with her, dummy. I went with her.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with the novelist Lydia Millett. Like a lot of young writers just starting out, she had her fair share of odd jobs in publishing.
I was on SWAT for the Prepared American, a gun magazine, and Fighting Knives, America's most incisive cutlery publication. So I actually was quite happy to be moved to porn.
But first, movies are often billed as events, but they rarely live up to that hype. James Cameron's Avatar is the real deal. It's set a century and a half in the future on a distant planet where humans are mining energy to send back to Earth, but they're at war with the native population there. A paraplegic ex-Marine signs up to go there, and he helps infiltrate the alien civilization.
The concept is to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs, babe. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
James Cameron is the creator of Terminator, as well as Titanic. With Avatar, he's taken on yet another insanely ambitious project to make the most realistic computer-generated images ever and do it all in 3D. James Cameron, welcome to Studio 360.
Hey, this is great.
So you have been famously burning to make this movie for a long, long time. Why were you so passionate about this?
Well, this is kind of a dream project for me because it's sort of the sum total of my childhood and my teenage years, all the fantasy and science fiction books that I read and, you know, being an artist in the sense of being a figurative artist and painter, illustrator. I was constantly drawing these alien creatures and robots and spaceships and everything. That's just kind of where my head was for that whole period. And so for me, it was a return to a kind of classic sci-fi or classic fantasy that I hadn't really done because I'd done the Terminator films, which were kind of, you know, kind of edgy, you know, kind of we called it tech-noir.
And pure sci-fi as opposed to fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. And this has a real fantasy component to it. Even to the extent that parts of it are quite dreamlike and beautiful and transportive, not in the way that a sci-fi thriller like the Terminator films or Aliens would be, although it has elements of that as well.
You've made big, technologically, narratively ambitious movies. Does this feel like the biggest?
It was certainly the most complex.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big Rubik's Cube with a lot of moving parts between the stereoscopic 3D live-action photography, the CG performance capture work that was done completely separately from that. Then there was kind of an interzone between those where we were mixing CG and live-action together. And then there was the length of it because it was a 4.5-year project, the first 2 years of which was just designing all the elements and creatures and landscapes of this world and developing the technology to be able to do it. I didn't even start with the actors until, after the first 2 years.
You're using, as you're suggesting, this entirely new kind of 3D cinema technology that you're calling Real D. How, in a relatively simplified way, does that differ from the 3D that's been around since we were children?
Well, let's go on a little history of 3D then. Okay, it started out a long time ago with the kind of red and blue you know, paper, cardboard glasses.
That you felt like an idiot wearing.
Everybody felt like an idiot. Plus, it produced headaches because it was just not a good process. And you know, in more recent years, with the advent of digital projectors and using polarized glasses, you're able to have an experience in a movie theater that doesn't produce a headache, if the 3D is authored properly in the first place. But the projection is excellent. And Real-D is one of these processes that's out there right now that you can see. There's also a Dolby process that's excellent. And there's the IMAX digital process, which is excellent. So you're able to go to any one of these theaters, whether it's IMAX or Real-D or Dolby, and have a spectacular experience.
And one of the things you should be praised for with this film, I think, is the great restraint you showed. There aren't a lot of those moments of, whoa,
the thing
is coming through the screen.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of these 3D movies, you know, seem to want to bounce tennis balls off your forehead every 2 seconds, you know. And all that does is remind you that you're sitting in a movie theater wearing a pair of glasses because you feel like stuff's coming out into the audience, and now you're aware of the audience, aware of the theater, and aware of the glasses. I wanted to have a kind of amnesia where once you go through that window into that reality, into that stereoscopic reality, you've forgotten about the fact that you're watching a 3D movie in a movie theater.
So you didn't want it, even though it is the first of its kind, you didn't want to have that kind of overplay that first of their kinds often do.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And certainly there have been good 3D films done in the last few years.
But digital.
Mostly animated.
Exactly.
Right? Not live action. There were a couple of shorter, smaller live action films made, like Final Destination 4, Journey to the Center of the Earth. I think the distinction with Avatar is that, you know, I'm considered to be a serious filmmaker. So for a serious filmmaker to make a movie in 3D, it has to not intrude into the cinematic experience. And it can't be a 3D experience first. It has to be a movie first. It has to be a real movie with real drama, real characters, and powerful emotions first and foremost. And oh, by the way, it's also in 3D.
Yeah. And presumably other filmmakers will want to get their hands on this. How will they do that? Do they pay you a royalty or what? How does that work?
Well, we're more than happy to supply Fusion cameras and tech support to anybody that wants to shoot a movie in 3D, a live action film. In terms of the performance capture, while we were doing it, once we sort of had it figured out, we invited many filmmakers to come in and see what we were doing. We just considered it completely open source. We didn't hold it close in a proprietary sense because we figured, what the heck, if we get more people doing this, they'll advance the tools. Everything will get better. When I come back to it again the next time, the software will be better, everything will be quicker, more efficient, and all that, because each new movie that's made using any of these techniques, you know, pushes the ball further downfield. The only exception to that, of course, is Weta Digital, who did all of the Finnish animation work on the
And that's Peter Jackson's company,
yeah, in Wellington, New
Hobbit
Zealand.
Hobbit entity.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a spectacular place. And we had 800 computer artists down there working on this movie. But the reason I say it's the exception is that Weta has certain proprietary software that they used on this film.
Well, what I felt myself being eager to see, as extraordinary, awesome as this film is the next movies that are maybe smaller, that aren't trying to do such a giant blockbustery thing.
Yeah, but see, these tools can be used on a movie of any scale to tell a story. You can create beautiful CG character, maybe only a single character. Maybe it's a human character who's being aged through a film, maybe not aged backwards like in Benjamin Button, but aged forwards. You know, maybe Clint Eastwood wants to do a movie as an actor where he appears at the age of 15 and at the age of 35. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
This can be easily done right now, and that would be on a picture that presumably overall would be on a smaller scale.
If it's as big as I believe it will be, does 2D movie making begin to go extinct?
No, I don't think so. I think 3D gets integrated into cinema, and this will depend really on directors. If directors, you know, want to make films in 3D, I think, you know, one thing Avatar might do, I don't think it waves a magic wand and changes the future. And what I think it does is it gives people permission who are serious filmmakers to think about making a movie in 3D that they might not have. For example, Ridley Scott came to visit and see what we were doing, and he had been planning on making a science fiction film after the film he's making right now, which is some variant on Robin Hood. I don't remember what the title is. I think it's called Nottingham. And he got very excited about the 3D. And I thought, well, look, if Ridley Scott, as serious an artist as he is, as consummate a visual filmmaker as he is, sees the potential in this, then it's going to evolve into a serious art form, if you will.
And now that you and other people have gotten a couple of thousand of these screens that can show it, there's now this pipeline that is going to demand it, presumably.
Well, we have over 3,000 domestically, and we have over, you know, I think 4,400 internationally. China, for example, has gone from 500 screens to 600 screens in 1 month in anticipation of Avatar. So it's definitely changing very rapidly right now.
But you don't think it's a thing like sound coming in or color coming in where within a decade it'll be that
ubiquitous? I think sound is the one huge change in film that's unequivocal. Color took 25 years to become ubiquitous.
Right, so you think it's comparable to that?
Maybe, yeah. And if you think about it, movies were still in black and white and color right up to the introduction of color TV.
Right.
It took a change in another area, in another medium, to force movies into color, all movies into color, to the point where, you know, Woody Allen had to get a clause excluding himself from the requirement for color in his contract with Orion. And so, you know, eventually there may be a Woody Allen clause for 3D that, you know, some artist that just doesn't like 3D or maybe is blind in one eye says, screw it, I don't want to make a 3D movie, you know, wants to be a purist, that 20, 30 years from now. But it'll probably take a change in another medium like television. And if television, as we absorb it in the home, is in 3D before it's ubiquitous in cinemas, it's going to force that change retroactively into film.
Yeah.
The same way color happened.
How interesting. You had you hired academic experts to help you dream up the geology and the botany, the biology, all these physical aspects. Did you ever feel like I'm geeking out too much here, I'm going overboard?
You can't. I mean, not for the hardcore fans of this type of fantasy who want a persistent world that's self-referential and consistent and detailed. And there are a lot of science fiction fans. And by science fiction, I mean hardcore science fiction fans that actually want the math to work.
Yes.
You know, want the physics to work.
Yeah.
But it was all done sort of as reverse engineering. You know, I proposed, okay, there are floating mountains in this movie. Now, you, Mr. Astrophysicist, figure out how I can have floating mountains.
Well, by the way, I wanted the explanation for that. How do those mountains float?
All right. Well, you want the explanation? There's this mineral called unobtainium, which is a room temperature superconductor.
Which is what we Earthlings are mining
there. That's what we're trying to get there. And there's a lot of it on this planet. It doesn't exist in our solar system. We need to go there to get it. A room temperature superconductor is something that theoretically could exist, but we have found no example of it on Earth. And a superconductor will float in a powerful magnetic field. So we talk about the flux vortex and these powerful magnetic fields that mess up everybody's instruments and all that. That's what's lifting.
Uh-huh. I know I can relax.
Exactly. Now you know that it actually was thought out.
The filmmaker James Cameron is my guest. We'll hear more from him in a minute. And later, we'll hear more about avatars. That's avatars with a small A. The fantasy lives that lots of us are leading right here, right now.
People who would never be caught dead playing a video game are spending a lot of time tweaking the way they project themselves into an online world in the same way that someone who fine-tunes the look of their chainmail in World of Warcraft would.
That and more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
And I am back with the filmmaker James Cameron. His new movie, Avatar, opens everywhere this weekend.
We have an indigenous population of humanoids called the Na'vi. They're fond of arrows dipped in a neurotoxin that'll stop your heart in 1 minute. And they have bones reinforced with naturally occurring carbon fiber. They are very hard to kill.
On this film, you invented all these plants and animals, geology, these floating mountains. Yet culturally and socially, the Na'vi, these alien creatures, seem very familiar. I mean, they are these Aboriginal people who hunt and gather and wear feathers and beads and loincloths. Why are they so much like American Indians, effectively?
Well, they're actually a melange of indigenous cultures. We looked at indigenous cultures in the Amazon, in Indonesia, in Africa, in America. I think giving them bows and arrows probably places them in most people's minds, you know, in your Native American sort of cultural niche. But in fact, there are lots of cultures around the world that use bows and arrows. It's actually a fairly common sort of first technology for hunting.
But you chose to stick to earth-familiar indigenous peoples. That was a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I just felt it made it more resonant with our world and with the theme of this is how we treat nature, this is how we treat indigenous cultures. We have a sense of this idea that we can just go anywhere and take anything we need if we can militarily. I don't mean we meaning America. I mean we meaning every superior society in history.
From the Spanish in the 16th
Romans,
century.
The Spanish, the English, the Portuguese. I mean there's no one here in the so-called civilized world that's without sin in this regard. It's a sense of entitlement.
Absolutely.
That extends to our overall view of nature and our interaction with nature, that we own it.
But in 2009, yes, the Romans, yes, the British, yes, the Spanish, the Portuguese, Dutch, everyone else. However, in 2009, one sees this film as, I did anyway, the biggest budget anti-imperialist, arguably anti-American film ever.
It's not anti-American. I love...
Put out by Fox.
No, there's an irony for you. Look, I'm a Canadian citizen, but I've lived in the U.S. for 37 years.
And you're not a famously lefty, squishy, liberal guy.
Not particularly, and I do believe in having a powerful military and having a good defense system. I felt that, to simplify it right down to its essence, I think Afghanistan is a just war and Iraq wasn't. And I think it's about how our leaders are or are not accountable to the American people. And they were not accountable to the American people correctly when we went into Iraq. And Iraq was, I consider not a just war. So, I threw in a couple of digs, at the Bush administration intentionally. But, that's not really the main theme of the film. I mean, I've also got some visual references to Vietnam, another war that, in my teenage years, I thought was insane. And I don't think anybody can really accurately describe why we should have been in Vietnam now after the fact in any way that makes any sense whatsoever.
There were no natural resources for us to get.
Yeah, there wasn't even any unobtainium there.
Do you have a favorite movie that would surprise and shock people who know your work?
I don't know. Let's see. Well, my favorite movie is The Wizard of Oz. I don't know if that's surprising or shocking, but it is. It
goes toward there, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Why is it?
Well, I've loved it since childhood, and I consider it still to be such an amazing, amazing kind of metaphor for life and just so beautifully executed, even though you can see the wires that hold up the scarecrow when he's on when he's on his stick and so on. But, I mean, I know every word of it, and now that I have kids and our eldest is 19 and the youngest is 3, I've got 5 kids. So now I can share it with them, have shared it with the older ones, and now I get to share it with the younger ones.
Well, certainly in Terminator and now in Avatar, there are moments that to me were not unlike the house landing in Munchkin Land and Technicolor coming on. That must be a sort of seminal impulse to try to do that.
Maybe. I mean, one can only imagine what it was like to sit in a movie theater in 1939 and see it go from black and white to color and how magical a sense of transport that must have been. And, my production designer on Avatar, Rick Carter, was always saying that in his mind it was The Wizard of Oz. And he even did this whole thing that he put up around his office where he had mapped all the different scenes in Avatar to The Wizard of Oz. I never quite felt that architecture mapped that closely, although I think that sense of wonder is absolutely part of it.
And if you play The Dark Side of the Moon...
backwards.
Yes. Certainly your career, one way it can be seen is as continually topping yourself or attempting to top yourself in, I've never seen anything like that before. Are you done with that? Or do you feel that's just what you do and you're going to have to keep trying to top yourself?
I don't know if it's topping myself. I mean, I think it's just, I'm always open. I'm always curious. I'm always trying to pioneer new things because that interests me. It interests me as an end in itself, not because of its effect necessarily in the final film. Just when I imagine a machine or a device, I have to build it because I can't not know whether it would have worked or not. It sounds goofy, but that's how I think.
You American, you.
I guess so, absolutely.
Well, James Cameron, thank you very much.
Hey, this has been a real pleasure.
Good.
All right, thanks a lot.
Here's the link room right here. This is where we're connecting to the Avatar.
Avatar opens this weekend, and if you'd like to hear my full 40-minute conversation with James Cameron, you can do so at studio360.org. James Cameron's film wasn't the only movie about avatars in 2009. There was Surrogates, starring Bruce Willis, and the movie Gamer, where Gerard Butler plays a warrior who was controlled by a teenage kid. Both movies tanked at the box office. But Studio 360's Eric Molinsky thinks that movies about avatars, even the flops, can tell us a lot about the way we live now.
Avatar is a very old word. It goes back to Hindu theology, when a god takes a human body, or an avatar, to walk on the earth. But avatars, as we know them, didn't start to the early 1980s, when a scientist named Chip Morningstar wanted to help sick kids in a hospital.
And so they built this idea of the avatar, which these kids would have a little visual representation, and they would log into a little local network.
Mark Stephen Meadows is a computer scientist and the author of the book, I, Avatar.
What that meant was that these kids that were normally locked up in little bedrooms in the hospital that couldn't spend time with other kids had the ability suddenly to become social and to be a little bit more of a normal kid in a way that their bodies weren't allowing them to do.
It sounds like the new James Cameron film Avatar, where a crippled soldier gets to move again through a second body. Cameron's film is the biggest blockbuster to deal with this idea in 10 years. Think all the way back to 1999. The most talked about movie was The Matrix by the Wachowski brothers.
Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Is it really so hard to believe?
In The Matrix, Keanu Reeves' character discovers that the world around him is just a computer simulation. His real body is lying in a tub of goo somewhere.
Boy, it really begins and ends with The Matrix.
Chris Baker is an editor at Wired Magazine. He says all these movies are exploring the same idea. What happens when we separate the mind from the body?
Yeah, that's something even more fundamental. Something that goes all the way back to, you know, Descartes and the idea of, are we just a brain in a vat? Something we all fundamentally wonder about. You know, can I trust the reality of the world around me?
Movies that flopped, like Surrogates, Gamer, Lawnmower Man, or Johnny Mnemonic, came down on one side or the other. Avatars are a dangerous idea. Don't separate the mind from the body. Or they're liberating. The Matrix is more ambivalent. Your real body may be in some scary place, but if you master the illusion, you can stop bullets with your fingertips, which is awesome. Mark Stephen Meadows.
I don't think that it's as distinct, this mind-body separation, as we might think, because ultimately your brain's just this, you know, piece of meat that's stuck inside of a dark box, and there's little electrical signals that are going in and out through that dark box, namely your skull, and that's what interfaces with the outside world.
In other words, we trust our brains to mediate the world around us.
And so if I'm running around or flying around or sexing around in a virtual world, my brain still ultimately reads that as real. Media is real. It ultimately says that you are living this experience that you're viewing.
It sounds like science fiction, but that's normal for Felicia Day. She's an actress that writes and stars in a web series called The Guild. It's about a group of people that live vicariously through the game World of Warcraft.
They always say, write what you know, and I really felt like there was a lot of material to draw upon.
Shot on no budget, The Guild is funny and surprisingly poignant, especially when the characters try to be friends in the real world.
My guild, my real-life guild, did meet in real life, and that was sort of a spoof that I used in episode 5 of season 1, where the group gets together and there's just a really awkward silence until they start talking about the game.
This is Dabu, real name.
Sijan Balakrishnan Goldberg.
And I'm Clara, real name Clara.
You use your real name for your avatar.
Yeah, well, I tried an alias on another game, but my kid picked it up and started calling me Mominatrix. My husband got pissed.
Well, it's great to finally meet everyone. After spending 6 hours a day together, we can finally put a face to a voice. Talk about real life for a change, right?
Felicia Day considers herself a booster for Avatar games, but she wants to keep at least one foot in the real world.
I have gotten to the point where sometimes I was too online and lost touch with the people who are in my life, really. And at the end of the day, I have to think, who's going to pick me up at the airport if I need a ride? And it might not be that guy who I play with in New Jersey.
Some of you are thinking, so? I don't play computer games. I would never have an avatar. Chris Baker says, think again. Have you ever had an email relationship with someone? Are you on Facebook? Well, that picture of you and the personality you craft around it, that's your avatar.
People who would never be caught dead playing a video game are spending a lot of time to tweaking the way they project themselves into an online world in the same way that someone who fine-tunes the look of their chainmail in World of Warcraft would.
Which comes back to the question, is it bad to separate the mind from the body? Well, I hope not, because we're all doing it. As we navigate through this new social landscape, it's going to be up to each of us to decide what's real. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
There is, of course, a music video for this song, Do You Want to Date My Avatar? And we've got it at studio360.org. And if you think I'm not the one, log off and we'll be done. Do you want to date my avatar? She's a star. Every year, the Library of Congress is choosing 25 historic recordings to preserve for all time as part of the National Recording Registry. This month, Studio 360 is showcasing some of those selections that were added this year. Today, The 2,000-Year-Old Man. This LP from 1961 introduced Mel Brooks to the world. Brooks and Carl Reiner, his straight man for the project, created a classic routine that has influenced generations of comedians. To tell the story of The 2,000-Year-Old Man, we've got three highly qualified experts.
See, that's how Carl would start with Mel. Give me your name and your occupation. My name, it's Billy Crystal, entertainer.
I'm Janet Coleman. I'm the author of The Compass, the improvisational theater that revolutionized American comedy.
My name is Rob Reiner, and I know one of the members of the duo of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks fairly well.
Sir, is it true that you are 2,000 years old?
Oh, boy.
The 2,000-year-old man idea started in the writer's room of the Show of Shows.
Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, all the writers for the Show of Shows.
Mel was a writer on the show and very rarely, if ever, on camera.
They were sitting in the writer's room as they are wont to do, and there was a lull in the session, and my father, trying to keep things alive, turned to Mel and said, I'm here with a man who I understand was there at the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And Mel instantaneously went into this character of this 2,000-year-old man and just said, oh, yeah, I know Jesus well. And the play started to break up.
So now they started doing it at parties all the time.
Whenever they got together, they just entertained their friends with it.
Then Steve Allen said to them, we have to record this.
And both my dad and Mel said, no, this is just, we just do this for our friends. It's just for fun. And Steve said, look, do it. You know, I'll pay for it. And if you don't like it, you can throw it away.
Sir, could you give us the secret of your longevity?
Well, the major thing is that I never, ever touch fried food. I don't eat it, I wouldn't look at it, and I don't touch it. And they never run for a bus, there'll always be another. Even if you're late from work, you know, I never run
the
for
impact
a bus.
Of the 2,000-year-old man is enormous, I think, in bringing this sense of freedom, this crazy Brooks Reiner freedom.
You know, you can talk to comedians of any age, and they'll know this stuff. They'll know it. They'll know it word for word. For comedians, it was like the Bible.
So these guys were on the cutting edge of moving comedy from this kind of, what do you do with red china? Well, it looks good on a yellow tablecloth. I mean, take my wife, please, and those kinds of jokes. They moved into more of a character-driven kind of comedy where the humor came out of plumbing the depths of a character and exploring a character and a situation.
You know, it's taking the premise and taking it one step further and further.
Yeah, well, there were no buses in the time of
Iraq.
No, in my time,
I mean, I...
What was the means of transportation then?
Mostly fear.
Fear transported you?
Fear, yes. You would see an animal would growl, you would go 2 miles in a minute.
My father has often said that the greatest motivator for a comic mind is fear. I think that's what it is. It's the fear of, you know, it's like we say, doing comedy without a net. It's all completely improvised. It's all ad lib. My father would ask Mel questions, and he would respond.
It's as if a realist painter who would be Carl and Picasso, who would be Mel, came together in one room and produced this amazing canvas of the history of the world.
Mel Brooks never says no to Carl Reiner. If he says, did you know any girls? Did you know Joan of Arc?
You knew Joan of Arc.
I went with her, dummy. I went with her.
Nowhere in history do we know of Joan going with anybody.
Well, they don't print that.
The 2,000-year-old man character is ethnic, and it's not offensive ethnic. It's satirical ethnic. He touches it in such a warm, embracing way.
It touches on an historical era that we may never meet again. We may never have guys who've been in the army who have this kind of exuberance about being alive, you know.
You got to remember that when they first started doing this routine, it was only about 5 or 6 years after the end of World War II. So, I mean, Mel playing this distinctly Jewish, old Jewish man, they thought, you know, people might think of it as anti-Semitic or, you know, maybe this is not a good light to put the Jews in. So they were very concerned about how it would go over with the general public.
Yes, but I think most people are interested in living a long and fruitful life, as
yes.
You have. You mentioned
fruit is good, too. You mentioned fruit. Fruit kept me going for 140 years once when I was on a very strict diet, mainly nectarines. I love that fruit. It's a half a peach, half a plum, but it's a hell of a fruit. I love it. Not too cold, not too hot, you know, just nice.
What has been
even a rotten one is good. I love it. That's how much I love them. I'd rather eat a rotten nectarine than a fine plum. What do you think of that?
They did a record 2,000-year-old man in the year 2000, and that was just as good and successful as anything they had done prior to that. My dad is trying to get Mel to do another one now. It's timeless. I mean, the basic ideas that they put forth in all of these different albums that they've done, you know, it strikes to the chord of the human experience, and that will, you know, that's not going to change. As they say, funny is funny, and funny will last forever.
And you can hear it. You don't have to see it. The great thing about the 2,000-year-old man is it makes you see it. And that's what's brilliant about this recording.
Hello there. This is 2,000 years talking to you from the depths of back there when we was. Now I'm still and they not. And I just want to say, keep your smile on your face and stay out of a Ferrari or any small Italian car. Stay out of them. And I want to tell you that it's been a wonderful 2,000 years. And you've been a wonderful civilization. And it's been a thrill living for 2,000 years. And eat a nectarine. It's the best fruit ever made.
Mel Brooks as the 2,000-year-old man with Carl Reiner from their original 1961 LP. It is now part of the National Recording Registry. We heard from Billy Crystal, Janet Coleman, and Rob Reiner. Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich produced our story. Is there some recording that you'd like to see preserved at the Library of Congress? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org. Back in 1992, on a mid-December night, composer Phil Klein got together a gang of his friends at a park in New York City. He gave everybody an old boombox and a cassette tape with a piece of music he'd made.
Anybody who didn't bring a boombox who'd like to carry one, I have some here, so you can come in and get one of mine.
The resulting musical performance was something Klein called Unsilent Night.
Anybody need a tape or a CD?
And he did it again the next year, and the next, and the next. What began as a local avant-garde thing is now a big annual tradition in a couple of dozen cities around the world. Phil Klein's 21st Century Unsilent Night accommodates MP3s, of course. Although, for the real ambiance, you do want to have some cassettes.
This is going to be the Unsilent Night.
We don't know much about it because this is our first time here.
A bunch of crazy people show up with their old rickety boomboxes and get tapes prepared by Phil Klein, I think.
We're all gathered around Washington Square Park in New York.
And we make this really beautiful procession to Tompkins Square Park.
And there's like tons of people here.
This seems even bigger than last year already.
Last year was almost 1,000.
Okay, is there anybody who still needs a tape?
It's my first time, but I wasn't told too much because they wanted me to have some of the joy of first discovery tonight.
Okay, everybody?
Everybody!
Everybody! In a minute, I'll just say 1, 2, 3, play, and we'll all hit play, and then we'll just, you know, I'll head through the crowd and just sort of follow me, and we'll end up in Tompkins Square in about 45 minutes. So, is everybody ready?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I hope you have your play button located, and your volume should be most of the way up or all the way up. Okay, here goes. 1, 2, 3, play!
Bill Klein's Unsilent Night happens this weekend in Charleston, San Francisco, Vancouver, and lots of other cities around America and the world. To hear more of the piece and an interview with Bill Klein, visit our blog at studio360.org. Coming up, every job has its slow moments.
I counted how many times people would ask me for the bathroom. One day it was 167. Another day it was 125.
Standing guard at one of the world's most famous art museums. Plus, a conversation with the fiction writer Lydia Millett. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Lydia Millett is the author of dark, funny novels that read a little like fairy tales. A lot of her characters seem slightly unhinged, like an early story called One Thing About a Goat, where a troubled woman accuses goats of causing all the problems in her life. Her new book is also about people and their strange relationships with animals. It is called Love in Infant Monkeys. And here is a strange fact I learned. Lydia Millett's first book was published while she was working as a copy editor at Hustler magazine.
The time that I was there, the period of time when I was at Hustler, Larry Flint wasn't really on the scene. And so I didn't, you know, occasionally we would hear him rolling down the corridor. What happened was that, you know, it was a really big, still is a really big company. And I was just in the copy pool. And but at first on SWAT for the Prepared American, a gun magazine. And Fighting Knives, America's most incisive cutlery publication.
My subscription ran out, I think.
Long ago. They may be defunct. But so I actually was quite happy to be moved to porn.
Your new book of fiction, Love and Infant Monkeys, is all about humans and animals. What was on your mind when you were writing these stories?
Each story was is a fragment of truth to it. It's all based on media stories on various celebrities.
Like Sharon Stone.
Sharon Stone.
And her Komodo dragon.
Right, her
incident.
Husband, her ex-husband being bitten on the foot by this Komodo dragon at the zoo. Actually, one story was based on my husband's run-in with, not exactly a run-in, that makes it sound dramatic, but with Noam Chomsky in the dump in Cape Cod near where we lived at the time.
And Noam Chomsky, as you depict, actually has a habit trail?
That is true. He was actually trying to get rid of this gerbil cage on that particular day in that dump.
Would you read one of these stories, from one of these stories?
I would. I'd be happy to. So this particular story is called Sir Henry, and it is only based on a very small kernel of information, which is the fact that at one time David Hasselhoff had a dog, and it was a dachshund, and the name of the dog was Sir Henry.
David Hasselhoff, of course, being a TV star of a certain era, and now kind of a living punchline.
Right, yeah.
Let's hear from Sir Henry.
The dog was serious, always had been. No room for levity. Those around him might be lighthearted. Often they laughed, sometimes even at his expense. The miniature size, bouncing gait, flopping ears. He was a dachshund. Not his fault. You were what you were. He would have preferred the aspect of an Alsatian, possibly a Norwegian elk hound. He viewed himself as one of these large and elegant breeds. This much could be seen with the naked eye, and the dog walker saw it. The dog walker was also serious, a loner, except for dogs. He prided himself on his work. He was a professional, with exacting standards. The dog walker gave his charges respect, as he saw fit. Some did not deserve it, and they did not receive it. To these frivolous or problem dogs, he gave only the curt nod of discipline. His favorite dogs had a sense of dignity. Theirs was a mutual approbation. Sir Henry was one of these.
That is Lydia Millett reading from her story, Sir Henry, in her new collection of stories, Love in Infant Monkeys. Did you have any qualms about using these real people in these fictional worlds that you created?
No moral qualms. The only kinds of qualms I ever have about that are sort of aesthetic, because I do like sort of purist, universalist brand of fiction that isn't time sensitive and doesn't have a short shelf life. But morally, no, absolutely not. I think the lives of people, famous people, belong to all of us, especially. And even the law would back me up on that, I believe.
Have you heard, speaking of the law, from any of the famous people's lawyers?
No, not at all, because, you know, we have this disclaimer thing we do in fiction where we say...
That completely disingenuous boilerplate?
Exactly, exactly. No, you know, we actually attempted to attract certain fan sites, and I actually wrote a letter to Sharon Stone asking her to read the story, but she perhaps did not have time.
Do you have pets?
I do. I have about 20 tropical fish and a pug dog.
Hmm.
Yes, I have a pug.
And you live in Arizona?
I do. I live out in the desert outside Tucson, so it's fairly remote, in the middle of a national park with many tall saguaros, you know, those 40-foot cacti that are iconic of the Southwest. So that's our yard, is those.
And why does a literary, snobby, National Book Award judging person like you choose to live there?
It is just the most beautiful place that I've ever encountered. To me, it's a place where I'd be happy to die. And I don't mean to sound depressing. It's just when I lived in New York, for instance, or when I lived in L.A., I always was just very depressed by the notion that I might once be walking these concrete streets and crumple over dead. And and at my house in the desert, I think, you know, things go on forever and are infinite and beautiful. And it's a life where every day I sort of encounter the sublime.
And you still have a day job. Tell me about that.
I work as an editor and a writer for my husband's endangered species group.
It's called the Center for Biological Diversity?
Correct. Quite a mouthful. So I work about 25 hours a week for them, editing press releases and writing for the webpage and things like that. And I love it, actually.
And were you involved in conservation as an activist, as caring about it before you married somebody who started this thing?
You know, I always cared about it, and I actually did a graduate degree in the conservation field at Duke. But I was never an activist because I always felt embarrassed. I'm embarrassed to carry signs around with reductive sayings on them and stuff. So I was never a natural activist, but I admire those who are.
But if you could give that up and just write fiction, would you?
No, you know, I have, for periods of my life, only written fiction for the most part. But I'm always happier when I'm doing something else as well. I need structure. I need to actually feel like I'm doing something that's not purely selfish.
So you need to earn the luxury.
I do. I feel a need to be grounded in doing stuff for other people.
And do you feel as though, not you, but you and like-minded people trying to show the world that we are on the edge of various environmental crises, is progress being made in convincing the world?
You know, I constantly think that it is, and then I'm disappointed by some new poll that, you know, say one recently showed that even fewer Americans actually believe that climate change is real than previously. And it just, it's a very difficult thing even to believe that we can have such an impact on the world. I mean, it's actually hard to get your head around in many ways.
Well, and it is the frog in the hot water problem, right?
Yes, of course, yeah. It's exactly that.
It's not so bad, right?
It's too late, it's too late, yes. Fried frog or whatever, boiled frog.
Boiled frog.
Right. Fried frog would be in a frying pan, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And alliterative, and I disapprove of alliteration in most
me
cases.
Me too, yes, definitely.
Lydia Millett, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Lydia Millett's new book of short stories is called Love in Infant Monkeys, and it's out now. Jason Eskenazi listens to our show from Brooklyn, New York. He was a self-taught photographer who jumped at the chance to take pictures of the Berlin Wall coming down 20 years ago. He stayed on in Eastern Europe, documenting the fall of communism in various places, in various ways. And even though he was there at first to shoot this big, epic historical event, a lot of his work is very intimate.
I was drawn to a whole gamut of situations, certainly everyday life, how people interacted with each other, how they bought food. But I also went into war zones. I went to Chechnya and things like that. I knew that there I would find raw emotions in such extreme situations. And they were personal images in some ways. I mean, the Russians reflected something about myself.
Eskenazi's photographs were published in Time and Newsweek. But life for a photojournalist isn't easy, and when he finally came back to the United States a couple of years ago, he had trouble finding work, and he needed health insurance.
I was totally out of money, and I had to come back again to New York, to Queens, and I came back to live at my mother's house because I had to just get a job. Well, my brothers, they look out for me, and one of them told me about a job that was opening up at the Metropolitan Museum of Art as a security guard. What you do is stand and make sure people are not touching the art, people are not getting hurt, or, you know, just the safety of the public, basically. The guards are with the art more than anyone else. I'm able to stand in front of a Van Gogh 2 inches away and to be able to look at it and stare at it as no visitor can, and certainly probably as no curator does. For me, that is amazing. That opened up things. I began to see the job as someplace where I can learn something and to help me in my photography. But working there is just mind-numbingly boring. Most of the day we answer same questions over and over again. Where's the bathroom? Where's the cafeteria? Where's the exit? And my legs, feet were just buzzing all the time. The blood was, you know, sinking down and not coming back up. And it was just physically very difficult. I needed to keep my mind going. And so I just started counting like, you know, like a mania. I counted how many times people would ask me for the bathroom. One day it was 167, another day it was 125. I kept lists of what people like to touch in the museum. I kept a list of the books the guards were reading. I kept a list of the guards' favorite artwork. One of the lists I made was what people's t-shirts said, especially if it was like giving me some message. One nation under surveillance, just do it. There's no great genius without a touch of madness. I also started to write limericks in the museum. There once was a museum so grand, but still they made their guard stand. To their feet the blood just sank, then their mind it went a blank, sending them into sleepy dreamland. And then I had the opportunity to be in the Robert Frank show. It's called Looking In. It's the 50th anniversary of the publication of The Americans. Robert Frank is like a superhero. He photographed America back in the 50s, to produce a body of work that has become a document of America, and in my mind as well, it's a look inside himself. It's a very personal journey as well. I knew the show was coming, and I got myself transferred from one end of the museum to the other in order that I could stand in that show every single day. There are a few photos in the Frank show that I really like. One of them is a man getting a shoe shine in a men's room. And even though it's an everyday thing in some ways, you rarely would take your camera out in a public bathroom and take a picture, yet that showed the intimacy of how Frank approached life. There was almost no subject matter that was off limits. He went everywhere and photographed everything. That was a model for me. I mean, I feel shooting that way as well. Being in the Robert Frank Show, it's like going to temple or something. It's going to a church. It's opening up an illuminated manuscript. And it has opened up a place in my brain. Working at the Met was both a physical and a metaphysical problem, and I think at this moment now I have cured both those problems, and I'm ready to go out and start photographing again.
The book of Jason Eskenazi's photographs is going to be published soon, but you can see some of his images now at studio360.org. The Robert Frank exhibition is on view at the Metropolitan Museum in New York for a couple of more weeks. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story. Is there some work of art that changed your life? If there is, tell us about it at studio360.org. And that is it for this week's edition. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Rob Weisberg,
Aaron Calabria,
Susie Karlowski,
Jordan Sale,
Jess Tiao.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, the foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. The Sounds of American Culture, our series highlighting works in the National Recording Registry, receives production support from the Library of Congress.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the game's afoot.
Well,
there isn't any time to waste then.
Is there?
A new Sherlock Holmes movie has us looking for clues about the legendary detective from Baker Street to Sesame Street.
Why, who are you?
Sherlock Hemlock, the world's greatest detective.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.